Support for the Projection Booth podcast comes from Stitcher Smart Radio. Now podcast listeners can access the latest episodes of the Projection Booth and thousands of other podcasts on the go without downloading or syncing. Stitcher instantly delivers episodes of your favorite shows to your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio can be found in the iPhone and Android app stores or on the web at stitcher.com/booth.
Saturday night at the movies. Kiss.
Fantasy. Reality. Which is which? Are fantasy and reality interchangeable? Or are they one and the same? Kiss knows the answer. But who and what are Kiss? Is Ace an interplanetary being? Paul a star child? Peter really a cat, Jean a demon? Occult powers, magic charms, and amulets, talisman, Kiss. Who controls who? What forces, evil or benevolent, govern these supernatural powers? This is the stuff of which dreams are woven. But at what point do dreams become nightmares? You don't really want to know. Or do you?
Greetings, victims. Welcome to the Projection Booth. I am Mike White, a.k.a. The Demon. Joining me is my co-host, the Space Ace himself, Mr. Rob St. Mary.
Where are my smoke bombs? You know, this Les Paul isn't going to smoke itself.
Also joining us this week is our special co-host and star child, Mr. John Stockwell.
Yo, 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 what's up, yo?
This week we're talking about the classic TV movie Kiss Meets the Phantom of the Park. First airing as NBC's Saturday night movie on October 28, 1978, the film was subsequently rescored and slightly re-edited for a European theatrical release as Kiss in Attack of the Phantoms, despite there just being one phantom to menace the story. It's Abner Devereaux. A mad genius and maker of incredible animatronics who tries to use the band Kiss as pawns in his sinister scheme to, well, populate an amusement park with lifelike robots, I guess.
I will destroy you! All of you! And you... You Kiss will be my instrument.
You wanted the best, and maybe Kiss Meets the Phantom of the Park isn't that, but it sure is amusing. So, John, as our resident historian, maybe you can shed a little groundwork here and tell us what was going on in the late 70s with Kiss. Where did these guys come from, and what were they doing at this point in their careers?
In 1978, when the movie came out, Kiss was at their height. They had just the month before released their four solo albums, where each guy put out a separate album and they all went platinum. And then at some point, somebody had this idea to do this movie, which ended up being, I think it's the worst movie ever made, which makes it one of the greatest movies ever to watch. At this point, you know, Peter and Ace were, you know, fully on drugs and booze and ready to leave the band. And if you watch the movie, it's just, it's so awful. And that's not even Peter Criss's voice in the movie.
This is unreal.
They, after the movie was done, they had an actor dub his voice. So it's a great piece of work.
Rob, go ahead. Tell us, what has been your history with Kiss Meets the Phantom of the Park?
I've seen it, I think, twice. I saw it on VHS probably when I was a kid. Like, someone had it laying around, and it is just horrible. I just didn't like it at all. And to be honest, and this is where you can send all the hate mail, is I'm not a big Kiss fan. I appreciate Gene Simmons' attitude. That Terry Gross interview is amazing.
But my impression is you don't have much sympathy for anyone. You're so into yourself. You're just so deep into yourself.
I think everybody should be. And so I'm aware that I'm not the best looking guy in the world. I'm aware of it. But when I go into a party, I will walk out with your girlfriend.
Just the concept of the band, in terms of it just being this like juggernaut of marketing and just continuing to do what they do, it is incredible in a lot of ways. But for me, it's like all of the theatrics just doesn't mesh with the music for me. Blood spitting and fire breathing, and the music is kind of like so safe for me. It's like soccer moms like this shit.
Songs about statutory rape and double entendres.
But it's so absurdist that I have to appreciate it in some way. I didn't get into it, and I think that it might just be by virtue of the fact of when I was born. I was born like 8 months after this movie came out. So I wasn't around in the heyday of Kiss. Like, I heard about Kiss when I got into like rock music, you know, when I first got interested in music, like 6, 7, 8 years old. But by then, they already had the makeup off and they weren't a cultural phenomenon. They were kind of like on the way out until they like got revived. They just didn't hold any interest to me. Now, if I was your age, as you guys were, when this movie came out and Kiss was big in the culture, I probably would have been a fan. But it just didn't hit me. Because I would say probably because of my age.
The one thing that you did bring up is if you were alive at the time, and I talked to my son about this a lot, when Kiss and a lot of bands at that time, they were bigger than life. And this is something that we don't have anymore with anybody. You know, when I was growing up, you had Evel Knievel, this guy who jumped his motorcycle, but he was a bigger than life personality. And Kiss was like this as well. You didn't know what they looked like. And it's this kind of thing that I talked to my son about it. I go, you'll never live through that because nobody does that anymore, and the world isn't set up like that anymore. You no longer have any bigger than life people. No matter who it is, as soon as you hear about them, people will try to tear them down or say, oh no, here's what they really look like and stuff like that. So it was a very, very different time.
Not that they weren't trying to find out what they looked like. I remember a great thing in one of the history books where it was like, oh, we have pictures of what these guys look like with their makeup off. And it was like they had Gene was Paul and Paul was Gene, the way they identified him. And it was two like random guys off the street as Peter and Ace.
I remember the night that this came on, I was at home with one of my sisters watching it. And I actually recorded the movie, just the audio, on a cassette recorder. And I had like, you know, two cassettes, and then I would go back and listen to it and listen to the live cuts. But even at that time, being a huge Kiss fan, I knew it was an awful movie, but it was still fun to watch.
You know, it's interesting that you bring up this whole thing about sort of how Kiss was so in the zeitgeist in that way. And as media guys, I mean, both John and I work in radio, work in media. I think it has a lot to do with the fact that in that era, you still just had the three networks. You just had radio, and radio was still huge. And it's like now there's so much media, there's so much proliferation of everything that there's no way that you can be like special in that way, where you can be like, I'm on all the networks. It's like, well, there's now 500 channels. So
right.
It just has to do with it being such a narrow band that everybody would know who you are. If you were on NBC and you had a movie on a Saturday night, like everybody knew. That was a big deal back then.
Right. And what's great about this movie, too, is when you watch it is when Kiss, their dialogue, like each person says one sentence and then they go to the next person. And it doesn't appear there were any second takes.
There was no Altman-esque layering of the dialogue in this.
But the thing is that, you know, in the credits, it's Hanna-Barbera. So when I look at it, I go, this is a cartoon. I'm like, if this is written by cartoon writers, it's put together like a kid's show, like a cartoon. Yeah. It's not a film in a traditional sense of what we would consider a movie.
By this time, 1978, you had mentioned that the solo albums were out. 77's when Alive 2, to me, one of their best albums ever, comes out. but they're already starting to go from the greatest rock and roll band in the world, at least according to them, to kind of being more like they're getting into more pop culture kind of things. You know, they've been on the Paul Lynn Halloween special, which is one of the best television appearances ever.
This is Ace, this is Gene, this is Peter, and this is Paul.
Oh, I love a good religious group. I can take one look at you four, and I can tell you how you got your name and how you got your act. You had a fight, and your mother's told you to kiss and make up.
They're starting to get into comic books. I mean, Gene is a huge comic book fan. We know that now. But back then, it was kind of a weird crossover for a rock and roll band to start getting into comics. I mean, they were in Howard the Duck. They had their own Marvel Super Special. And they're, like, you know, fighting Dr. Doom in that. And they're mixing their own blood into the ink. And yeah, and then you get to this. And yeah, you're right, Rob. This is a totally, like, a cartoon movie. I mean, to the point where they have, like, cartoon sound effects. The guy who's doing Peter Criss's voice is one of the Hanna-Barbera talents, you know, Michael Bell, who has just done all of these, you know, voiceovers. So you listen to it and you're like, God, I know that guy. Where have I heard him? Oh, probably on the Super Friends before.
Yeah. And it's so cartoony and the voice just doesn't match you. Every time he speaks, it sounds completely like an animated person.
One of the things that this movie has in spades is plot. And one of the things that it's really kind of lacking is Kiss. I mean, we have Kiss at the very beginning doing rock and roll all night, and they're in this amusement park, and Gene is like 100 feet tall at one point, and at another point, which is great because these girls are walking along, they look up and they see this huge Gene Simmons, and they just keep walking. It's like, Gene Simmons is, you know, actually he's probably more like 250 feet tall. You would think you would get a better reaction from these people. But anyway, bam, we go right into the movie, and it takes, what, like another half an hour before we see Kiss again. John, having seen this the first time around, were you just like champing at the bit? Just like, where is Kiss? Because I know I am like that every single time.
Yeah, because, you know, this is pre-internet. So yeah, I couldn't go on to YouTube and watch what these guys look like in concert. I mean, there was no bootleg video. There was nothing. So I was just waiting and waiting and waiting just to actually really see them perform live and see them do something. And it's so hard for people to understand that now. You know, I mean, I had the only access I really had to Kiss or seeing what they do would be maybe looking at a magazine. But to actually see them, you know, speak and see them, you know, perform live, I was waiting for it really just due to the fact that, you know, there was no other place to see it. There was no internet. There was no immediate access to them.
So we've got the stories unfolding and we've got all these different things going on. We've got Sam and Melissa. You know, Sam works for Abner Devereaux, who I mentioned in the beginning, the master criminal guy who works at an amusement park.
Are we at Comic-Con? What's going on? You're getting far too into the plot here. I will post my opinion on the internet for all to read. No, go ahead.
One of the first times I realized that I wanted to do a podcast was I was listening to another podcast and they were trying to do Kiss Meets the Phantom of the Park and they never talked about the plot whatsoever. And it's like, they didn't even talk about Abner Devereaux. And it's like, he's kind of crucial to the story, guys. It's great because there are all these things that are in here and they just get completely dropped once Kiss gets on the scene. I mean, the whole fight between Abner and Calvin, the guy who runs the park, you know, and then some of my favorite characters, Chopper, Dirty D, and Slime, these three bikerish dregs of humanity that are wandering around the park.
Look who we got here, some acrobats.
And the walls come tumbling down.
Hold it, that's enough of that, not in this park.
You talking to us?
What's your beef? You a cop.
It's cool. Chopper and Slime don't hurt nobody unless they want to.
Fun is fun, but that's carrying things.
Just who are you anyway, old man?
I happen to be...
Who do you happen to be, huh?
I'll tell you who he is. He built this park, and I run it.
Now, if you can't control yourself, you'll be out of this park before you get in.
Well, the thing is with, you want to talk about the plot a little bit, is I realized that this film lapped itself in the first 10 minutes. There seems to be two scenes that almost take place back to back, where Calvin and Abner are speaking, I believe, or it's Calvin and someone else, and they say exactly the same thing twice. Yeah. It's like, oh, Kiss is coming. It's going to be crazy. We're going to get mobbed. And then it's like shot of something. Oh, Kiss is coming. We're going to get mobbed. It's going to be crazy. It doesn't further anything. It's like the exact same scene twice, like 10 minutes into the film.
They have their own fan club. They call themselves the Kiss Army.
This cat is going to put us on the map once and for all, Sneed.
And I totally love the totally, like, non-interested voiceover.
Kiss is in concert, starting tonight, for three great nights. Remember, Kiss tonight. Kiss.
There's going to be a gigantic crowd. Come see live on stage. Ace, Peter, Gene, and Paul.
To me, some of the best characters are the security guards, and one of them being played by Brian James, where it's like he should be the star of the film, really, but he's only there just kind of, you know, to the side. And I wonder if, like, this kind of gave him some inspiration for when he went to play Leon in Blade Runner, because you have the whole, you know, animatronic, you know, artificial people kind of thing. It's like, I smell conspiracy.
Oh, Abner Devereaux, sure.
Well, this Abner Devereaux, where can I find him?
His workshop's located underneath the Sky Tower.
You mean underground?
Yeah, way underground.
I have to say, though, other than Brian James, my other favorite person in the film, who barely even, he doesn't get a line, he just is kind of hanging out, is the real Don Steele, who's there hosting a Kiss lookalike contest where you have all these 8 and 10-year-olds with their faces painted.
And you always see people with the star on the wrong eye, because when they look in the mirror, they do it on the wrong eye. I was at a Kiss show once in Iowa, and that had the most stars on the wrong eye. People there don't know how to use their mirror, but anyway.
Now, if you really want to go nuts, you do the whole bandit makeup.
Which is what I wore for a while in the Kiss tribute band.
Yeah, I did write in my notes that we don't see them again until 27 minutes later, at least in the European cut of the film, and we'll talk.
Oh, dude, you're hardcore. Very good. And you know, the European cut has different music, too. It has, like, some I think, solo album stuff.
Ton of solo album stuff. They take out a lot of the cartoony music and stuff, and they take out a lot of the cartoon sound effects and everything, and they rearrange some of the scenes and stuff. I mean, that whole thing that Rob was just talking about, how it kind of laps itself in the first 10 minutes, there's a lot more conversation between Calvin and Abner, and they're going along on this monorail and all this kind of stuff. And there's more to the fact that Abner is kind of screwing stuff up in the American version. Like the rides are kind of going crazy, and he was like, oh, I just put these twin turbine engines in here. And Calvin's like, what are you doing?
The new dual turbine engines I've been experimenting with.
Trying them out with people on it? I mean, engines are twice as powerful as the old ones. Are you crazy?
Rob, Mike is pretty awesome. Are you just, do you just kind of ride his coattails on this program, for crying out loud? Good stuff, Mike.
Yeah, pretty much. Well, I mean, when it comes to Kiss, I got to give it to him. And plus, he has this tendency to want to read everything. And as you know, I'm functionally illiterate. So anytime there's a book to be read, I don't read it. He does. And then we talk about it.
I got you.
And the first time we hear Kiss speak isn't until like 33 minutes in, when we have the incredible line just of,
it's our child.
No gratitude need be voiced. Your mind speaks to us.
You're looking for someone, but it's not Kiss.
Gene's voice is going through this like harmonizer echo the entire time. You know, that would be awesome if you could really talk like that.
I absolutely thought it was incredible, and I love the scene where they're just hanging out by the pool and
with these enormous robes on.
It's so ridiculous and weird and funny at the same time, that whole scene.
Ahoy, mates. The ownership approaches.
Aye, me bucko, with this scurvy crew steaming close behind, and I do mean steaming.
There they are. Sorry to bother you boys. But we had some trouble at the park last night, and everything seems to point to you.
Gene's clean.
A pussycat. Almost.
And then Paul has this, like, special vision hearing thing.
Look, someone vandalized our park last night, smashed some of our buildings and injured a few of our guards. Well, Gene, they think it was you.
Think? It was him.
Or his twin.
Gene's brother was an only child.
Easy, Catman. They are serious.
And they've got guns.
This guy's dangerous. I want him locked up.
All right, look, don't get excited, Sneed. I mean, let's talk about this privately.
I'm inclined to believe you and the boys, but this group
brings in $200,000 a show.
And yeah. he's paying close attention to what they're saying, like on the other side of the pool or whatever.
About 12 feet away, really. I mean, to be honest.
He's sweating the possibility we might pull out. He's just plain sweating.
Which is funny because if you know Gene's sexual proclivity, I'm sure he has pulled out quite a few times.
Whoa, hey! But yeah, they're all around that pool, you know, in these enormous director's chairs with robes on. It's great.
Yeah, that scene is just incredible and ridiculous at the same time.
Yeah, the pool scene doesn't make any sense to me because they're not going to swim and they're not really getting any sun in those robes.
Maybe they're taking a swim.
Rock and rollers don't bathe.
I think that this movie, much like several other things that I've seen recently, basically, but this one specifically shows me just how much cocaine was running wild in Hollywood in the 70s. It's just incredible. Like, no one could come up with this film unless they were really high.
And nobody along the way said, you know what, maybe we should stop. Maybe we shouldn't put this out there.
Well, I'm curious how the guys who ended up doing this gig, I mean, the guy who directed it, Gordon Hessler, he'd been around forever. He's been doing, you know, Westerns and, you know, from like the 60s on, he'd been directing. He did a ton of TV, did a, you know, bunch of, you know, movie of the week, all this kind of stuff. But the guys who wrote it, Don Baudet and J. Michael Sherman, they had like one credit to their names before, and I actually tracked down that movie that they wrote called Too Hot to Handle, this sexploitation movie, and it was pretty bad. I mean, I was enjoying it a little bit, but mostly just because the main character was wearing these very, very revealing outfits and had huge tracts of land. But yeah, it was just...
As I'm thinking about this film, what I think would be an excellent movie would be, have you seen Shadow of the Vampire?
I've not.
Shadow of the Vampire is a movie about what it was like, supposedly, to make Nosferatu, the old German silent vampire film. Awesome. What they need is a similar film for this about what the hell was going on the set, reenactment-wise, because I think that would be immensely more interesting than this film to watch.
The making of Kiss Meets the Phantom.
Exactly. Because these guys act like you were saying, like Peter and Ace are just, they're gone.
They're done.
They're somewhere.
They are convinced that they will have successful solo careers and they just want to get out of the band.
They're just off on another planet somewhere because they're coked to the gills. And then the whole thing is, it's like, how the hell did they, I would just love to be like a fly on the wall to figure out how the hell this movie even got made, as you were saying, because to me, when I look at it, there's certain points where it's like, okay, that's stock footage. Like,
yes.
All this stuff with the roller coasters and the kids on the roller. I'm like, that's stock footage. Like I said, that scene is the same thing twice.
They even have some like Star Trek, like stunt doubles where it's really bad. And I think Ace's double is actually a black man. I'm not making that up.
No, it totally is. Especially during that fight with those werewolf guys. He changes to a black eye for quite a bit of the fight. It totally reminds me of that scene in I'm Gonna Get You, Sucker, when the woman changes into the guy with the mustache, the white guy with the mustache.
Bad stunt doubles are one of my favorite things to see in movies.
When Gene goes nuts, the whole doppelganger thing. I love that. That is so much fun.
Yeah, you said Star Trek stunt doubles. They even have Star Trek sound effects in this. Like some of the, it's like the, when the floor opens up, it's the Star Trek door opening.
One of my favorite parts too is when the robots come out on stage to sing, and instead of Hotter Than Hell, they sing Rip and Destroy, which is awesome.
Oh, and that really incites the crowd, I'll tell you. It's great. In the original script, they actually make a point to say only the people who are on the fringes of the crowd are doing the destruction. None of the members of the Kiss Army are involved in that. They actually point that out. It was great. And in the original script, too, was terrific because Ace only had one line. The whole time he would just say, and everybody would like translate for him like he was Chewbacca. You know, one of the other great things about the script is the opening. I mean, there's a part at the very beginning where it kind of goes through and describes all four members of Kiss, which is terrific. And they even describe Ace as being Harpo. But the other thing is the incredible voiceover, and we started the show with this, and I want to thank Eric Larson for recording that for us, because that it is this great ominous, you know, like powerful voiceover of what Kiss is all about, and that kind of captures the whole kind of spiritual hocus-pocus thing that they're going for with this script as well. I mean, before we get to the talismans, we do know that there's going to be something very supernatural about the script.
You were talking about how this movie borrows from other things like, you know, the Star Trek sounds and stuff like that, but I actually find something in here that also has borrowed forward into pop culture. And this is when he opens up the suitcase with the talismans in it. And
I didn't know they existed.
And the kid's face lights up as he opens up the suitcase. That is like a shot-for-shot recreation of when they open up the suitcase in Pulp Fiction. I think that's where Tarantino got it.
You know, that's a very, very good point.
And then I think that the Kiss movie borrowed the Dolomite-style fight scene.
Yes.
From Dolomite. So there he goes. <That's right. laughs>
So yeah, we've got Peter being overdubbed by this guy. We've got Ace, who in one version only says, you know, one line, but then he does have lines. He fought for his lines. You got Gene with his overmodulated voice, and you got Paul with that thick New York accent, which is so ironic to me because Gene is probably the best actor of the four, and he's probably the guy who was really into this, and yes. They just like cover up his voice the whole time and really don't give him a whole lot to do. You know, I think that's why it was the Gene robot causing all the destruction, because he wanted to do more stuff in the film.
Yeah, and he growls like a lion at one point, too.
Which seems to be, I guess his secret power, his superpower is spitting fire and growling and stuff, because they all have their own, you know, special power and everything, which is terrific, too.
The most horrific part of this film for me is Paul Stanley's chest hair. You can't yes. tell me that's not a bath mat glued to his chest.
He's muy macho.
See,
but that's very 70s too. I mean, that was very, you know, that was very sexy then. Like today, people like shave their bodies from head to toe. You know, back then, like being all furry like that, you know, the chicks loved it.
You know, I just saw that Krabs has now been. The crabs are now going extinct. And in the 70s, that was definitely an issue that was never going to happen. You had to wait until 2013 for pubic lice to go away.
We need a NC-17 rating on this.
Okay, we're going to take a break, and we'll be back after we play some interviews with the producer of Kiss Meets the Phantom of the Park, Terry Morse Jr., and another Kiss historian, Ron Albanese.
We interrupt your podcastual programming for this HollywoodLeak.com news break. Here's the latest from HollywoodLeak.com. OWN network tanking. Oprah wants her cars back. CEO grows mustache, changes his name to Walrus. And a quick pilot casting update. You didn't get it. Entertainment news is always leaking. For these stories and more, go to HollywoodLeak.com.
All right now, for all you boppers out there in the big city, all you street people with an ear for the action, I've been asked to relay a request from the Gramercy Riffs. It's a special one for Movie Meltdown. That's every lie, a bunch of movie geeks with a show about some crazy movies. And I do mean Movie Meltdown. Here's a hit with them in mind.
Come check out Movie Meltdown. News, reviews, and interviews about your favorite thing, movies.
$10 yeah. for the budget matinee.
The budget matinee.
That's why we don't go to the theater.
That's right.
Come by and check it out at moviemeltdown.com.
I kind of want to be able to mix it up and tie everything
variety
into one big conglomerated mess of movie geekdom.
And I don't know
that's
if we could.
Are.
That's what we are.
Movie Meltdown. For movie geeks, by movie geeks.
Be looking good, Movie Meltdown. You hear me, babies? Good. Real good. Adios.
You love midnight movies, don't you? But can you handle midnight movies 24 hours a day?
Your death will be indescribable.
Find out on Black Flag TV. The first viral television on the web. Black Flag TV is entirely dedicated to haunting horror, science fiction, and cult movies. Broadcasting live, 24 hours a day, obscure independent movies and classic horror. Make Black Flag TV your sanctuary for the horror genre.
They're coming to get you, Barbara.
Visit us now, blackflag.tv.
Androids will soon take over most of man's menial work, but my people are far superior. Almost human.
I was curious how you got involved with the project.
Well, I was under contract to Hanna-Barbera at the time. We had done The Gathering, shot that in right out of Cleveland in Chagrin Falls. They're the ones that brought the script in there. It was made for television, for NBC, Movie of the Week. And I was assigned to it as the producer. And we were going to go at one time to Richmond, Virginia, but we decided to shoot it here in L.A. and use Six Flags out there for the, amusement park. We shot it in 4 weeks. You know, that's what you do on television movies, 20-day shooting, and you get them done. But it was a terrific experience.
Good. I wasn't sure how it was, because I know Kiss, for a long time, they wouldn't let people talk about the movie when they were interviewing them.
Uh-huh. I don't know what the negativity was. You know, at that time, they were having trouble with Peter Criss and Ace Frehley even then. In fact, we couldn't find Peter Criss to do some voice work. We found Ace in New York, to do the... A lot of times when you shoot on the set or areas that you have to redo the dialogue and loop them, we call it, our automatic dialogue replacement, ADR. As I say, it was made for television, and the Hanna-Barbera went ahead and hired another editor and made it into a feature film, you know, and released it again as a feature film. It's not the same as the television version. A couple scenes were added here and there, and more music was added in it. But it ran as a theatrical movie, which I haven't seen yet, by the way. Some people are trying to get me a copy. I understand it's in their pack, you know, where they have the, they release both of them, the TV version and the theatrical version. But it's done well, and it was a lot of fun making it.
How was the shoot? I mean, was this pretty much just run-of-the-mill for you, kind of like, you know, this is your job, I'm going to get in there, I'm going to do this thing, and in, out, kind of done? Did you think back on it years later, or is this just something that you do? Because, I mean, your credits are amazing, how many things you've produced and done so many different things on these different shows.
I did a lot of, as you'll notice, a lot of TV movies because they were fun to do. And you prepare them for 6 weeks, shoot it in 4 weeks, and then you get the post, get it done in, 5 or 6 weeks, and you're out of there onto something else, where a movie will take, you know, months. So it was fun. It was a good experience. You know, they'd never been in a movie, and of course they'd been interviewed a lot and in front of the cameras a lot, but I think they had fun while they were making it, but they were having their own personal battles at the end, and I understand now that Ace Frehley and Peter Criss aren't even with them anymore. They've got two replacements for them. And the main guys are Gene Simmons and Paul Stanley. You know, they're the two main guys. And especially Gene, he really was the leader of the group. One thing was kind of interesting, they did their own makeup because they used to do it, you know, when they did their own shows, when they do their concert tour, they would make themselves up. So when they come on the set, we have makeup and hair people there. No, they didn't need them. They went ahead and made themselves up because their calls would be ready to shoot at 9, you know, and so they knew how much time it took to put all that makeup on and get that stuff on. As I say, we shot out at Six Flags. We shot a full concert, shot 18 songs. And on the radio, a couple of radio rock stations here in L.A. said, come on out, you know, it won't cost anything to get in to watch Kiss shoot a movie and do a concert. Well, we must have had 20, 30,000 people out there. They just all came in by the droves. And so we had a great crowd. And it was they just went through one complete run of all their songs. But they were having so much fun so much trouble with Peter at the time, he finally walked off and just left them. And we had about 3 or 4 songs to go, so we had somebody in the wings ready to just to go in there and sit back there and not do any close-ups on them, but just be part of the master shots and stuff behind.
Right.
And I know Peter made a big deal, you know, because he insisted on putting in that one song, you know, where he sang the solo out there in the backyard of their place. They didn't want to do that, but he just made such a stink of it that we put him in. And it wasn't bad. It was a nice song, if you remember it.
Oh, yeah. Doing some Beth out there by the pool. Yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Right.
A lot of great scenes by the pool. I always love the one where they're in the really tall chairs.
Yeah. Yeah, we had those made up for him. Interesting little side note. Do you remember the actor Joseph Cotten? I guess he was from Third Man. His son was an actor, and he started out in the part as the main lead. And when Joe Barbera saw the daily, he says, no, that won't work. We got to have a blonde kid. So we put in, I forgot his name now, the actor, but Terry Lester. That's the guy that became Sam. He became a soap star after that. Went soaps for years. It was an interesting experience. As I say, we shot for 4 days. We had meetings, Gordon Hester, the director, and myself, with Gene Simmons one day in Beverly Hills at a nice restaurant, and he brought his girlfriend. It was Cher at that time. She came to the dinner with the little kid, too, that became the little girl that became a guy.
Chastity.
Yeah.
So you got to see them out of makeup then, huh?
Oh, sure. At that time, you know, they didn't want anybody to know what they looked like without makeup, but, you know, people find out and stuff like that.
What was it like working for Hanna-Barbera?
Oh, that was fun. Hanna and Bill Hanna and Joe Barbera. It was fun. We did a lot of stuff there. You know, two or three movies. One of them is a terrific movie called The Gathering. It was a Christmas movie. And we did another one in Dallas called The Beasts Are Loose in the Streets. It was, you know, I worked with them for about a year, just going from one thing to the other.
Come and see the fireworks with the KISS concert tonight.
So I want to know what you've done so far in your project, where it's at, if you're going to pick it back up again, and really kind of what inspired you, what made you such a big fan of Kiss Meets the Phantom of the Park?
Well, you know, I was one of those kids that watched it when it first broadcast in 78, and my parents at the time had one of those cool Magnavox console TVs, and you know, they thought it was really cool because it wasn't just a wood console. It was like a bleached wood console. And this thing was like a TV that was on an ancient Roman column. And I sat right in front of it with a frozen pizza. And the only problem was my parents were having people over. And the TV was in the rec room. And my mother and I had a quick argument. I'm like, no, I'm watching this KISS movie. And sure enough, they had the people over in the back of the room, you know, hosting and having fun. And I was glued to the set in the front of the room. And at the end of it, we had this giant shag carpet. And I don't know if you remember in the 70s, we had a carpet you can kind of like draw in the carpet. And at the end of the movie, I like got up and in the carpet with my hand made like a giant KISS logo, like just cementing my fandom in KISS forever. Before that, I had a couple A-tracks starting with Rock and Roll Over. But the movie itself really just cemented a time in my life. And, you know, and just being a KISS fan, which basically is my life. So, there you have it.
How old were you, if you don't mind me asking, how old were you at the time?
I was 8. The perfect, you know, and as I was, you know, doing some research for the book and stuff, you realize that anybody that was between 7 and 10 really ended up filling the seats during the KISS reunion. So, it really started during 78, which ironically is a sort of lambasted time in KISS history, if you will, by not only the band, but fans. Oh, they got so commercial. Oh, they were doing this and doing that. But it really was, you know, doing something that they could, you know, put away in the bank and cash in on down the road.
So I know for a lot of years it was pretty tough to see the film other than, what, like a Good Times VHS release, but you managed to track that down.
Yes. The movie, you know, it did get the Laserdisc release, which at the moment I'm kind of forgetting when that popped out. But it may have been a little later on, but, you know, I saw it upon the first airing. Some people had copies of it on VHS collectors when VCRs became common. Some people had those. But then, of course, there was a rare CBS late night showing in the 80s, I believe around New Year's Eve, 85 or 6. And me and my buddies, you know, we were a big KISS neighborhood, and we made sure to not only tape that, but we all watched it when it aired. And, you know, we were jumping on the phone, are you watching it, and all that stuff. So, you know, between the original airing and then subsequently the re-airing, then later VHSs, it kind of did chug along having this underground classic vibe going on.
So what kind of tipped the scales for you to make you want to, you know, pick up a pen and start writing about this film?
You know, I've always been a writer, you know, starting in college and things. And at the time of having this idea, I had just come off of being an editor of an entertainment paper in Hoboken, New Jersey, Frank Sinatra, you know, all that. And it was a good entertainment paper, and it really increased my chops with writing and pop culture stuff. I really enjoyed that. And being a KISS fan, I think, Phantom is fascinating to me in the sense that it's a really good moment in time as a KISS fan, whether you like it or not, but it's also a really cool pop culture artifact. I believe, Mike, that it's really a blender of some of the best of the 70s. So my idea was, wow, if I'm going to write something about something I know and love, Kiss Meets the Phantom really fits the bill because I think KISS fans would love it, and I think pop culture fans would love it. And not only that, to this day, and these were my thoughts 12 years ago, not much has come out on the film itself.
It was something you weren't supposed to ask us about, so hasn't been a whole lot of stuff written about it for a lot of years, I think.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of shrouded in mystery, you know, and the band's overall, you know, mythos, you know, that's one of the sidesteps. That's one of the missteps, rather. That was something they shouldn't have done, and I think it's something they should have done, and I believe it today.
How did you go about tracking down some of the folks that were involved with the film, and who all have you spoken to about it?
Well, as I started doing this, and these, you know, this was, again, in 99 I started doing it, so this is kind of in the earlier days of the Internet, and so I had to track down people the old-fashioned way, you know, maybe I knew somebody who knew somebody who knew somebody. The Internet wasn't that great in terms of research, but eventually I did cobble together a little group of people, and that did have a chain reaction. So, for example, I talked to Michael Sherman, who was the co-writer of the script, and of course, in turn, he hooked me up with Don Boudet, and those were the two guys that wrote the script. And then, you know, they'd say, oh, you should talk to the art director. And then I got lucky, and that was Art Levinson, ironically, I believe. Get it, Art? And then I talked to, I found Gordon Hessler, who was the director, of course, and he was just great, and he turned me on to a couple people like Deke Hayward, who was the executive producer of the project. So all in all, Mike, I ended up talking to about a dozen people. I probably have about 30 hours of interview tape.
Wow, that is amazing. And it's so great because so many of these guys have passed on since then.
Yeah, it's true. And no disrespect intended, but either Sherman or Boudet passed, and I think it was like right after I interviewed them. And speaking of death, not to be morbid, but I had interviewed Deke Hayward at his house in Malibu, you know, in the hills over there. It was just great. You know, he said, why don't you come on over? So I said, cool. You know, I got my rental car, and I just started driving up the mountains of Malibu and driving, and I'm twisting and I'm turning. And finally, I come to this gate, and it's the only gate on the street. There are no houses around. And I had to go up to the intercom, you know, and I said, hey, it's me, Ronnie Albanese. It's the guy that's doing a book on KISS. The gate suddenly opened, you know, no voice or anything. And we drive up some more, and then I'm in this guy's house. And the house was literally on the edge of the earth, it seemed. You looked one way, all you saw was the Pacific Ocean. You looked another, all you saw was a forest, you know, the hills of Malibu. And it was quite striking. And then we sat down, and he had some wine out and, you know, some snacks. And we talked about KISS in this mansion in the Malibu Mountains for a couple hours. Yeah, it was a big experience, you know, and I had a buddy with me, and he was really up on some stuff that D.K. Hayward had done earlier in his career. So it really was a combo, you know, old Hollywood meets KISS kind of thing.
You should probably say who that is just for our listeners.
Yeah, D.K. Hayward was executive producer. Deke is his nickname, D-E-K-E, and Lewis is his first name, I believe, Lewis Hayward. But he did a lot of stuff in Hollywood, and as time went on, he did some stuff with Hanna-Barbera, which is how he ended up on the KISS project. Right before or after the KISS project, he did an awesome piece of pop culture history where it was called The Legend of the Superheroes. It was actually a live-action type of Super Friends. It just recently came out on DVD through Warner's Video On Demand program, and this was a really tacky yet awesome 70s thing.
You have also spoken, I think, a few times to Bill O'Coin.
Yeah, Bill O'Coin, he was more than cool. I'm actually hanging out with another KISS fan buddy of mine right now, and he's interviewed Bill as well. And, you know, God rest his soul, Bill was like the coolest guy. I had actually interviewed him in person, and he was at a KISS convention up in Rhode Island. He said, yeah, sure, come on up. And I jumped in my car and drove the 3-4 hours that it took to get up there. We hung out, you know. It was us and a bunch of guys. Actually, Bruce Kulick, formerly of Kiss, among them. Bruce was in the no-makeup version of Kiss for 11 years and made an awesome contribution to Kiss. And he's just a great guy. And we all hung out. But he made sure to give me some time where we just, you know, shot the breeze about this movie. And he gave me some great, you know, recollections about it. I think even at that point, the early 2000s, Bill may have still had some mixed feelings about the project.
Yeah, did anybody else? I mean, because I know that this is kind of, you know, some people love it, some people hate it, and some people are right down the middle.
Some of that is kind of, you know, rearview mirror stuff. You know, when you look at any band or any kind of film series, you say, well, you know, Rocky and Rocky II were awesome. Rocky III is when it went a little commercial, and Rocky IV, come on. But you know what? Everybody runs around saying the lines that Ivan Drago said in Rocky IV. It's sometimes in those missteps that a pop culture institution is really formed. I love all weird records by bands, you know, like the Ramones, Cheap Trick, and bands I grew up with. And I think Phantom really helped to flesh out the thing. It may have gone a little too far in one direction where the members themselves felt uncomfortable. You know, they were aware. They were a superhero type of entity. They were aware they could do this. But when they really did it, you know, making a mainstream TV movie to week, I think that's when they felt a little embarrassed and simply uncomfortable. You know, the band never liked it, so some fans kind of decided with that. And other people may just take it too seriously. I never was able to penetrate, you know, the inner circle of Kiss at that time and talk about it. As years have gone on, they've talked a little bit more here and there. But again, you know, they have their company line. They have to give you the outline of Kisstory, and that's supposed to be one of the bad points. You know, we made this mistake, blah, 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 and you know, it fractured the band and all this. So it's not something they would maybe open up on and really maybe give their personal feelings. Now, Mike, having said that, when I started interviewing this for this, you know, with people, I said, wow, this is great. They're probably the last guys I want to talk to. Because when I started talking to others, they really had such good recollections. For some people, this is the biggest thing they did, the biggest thing they ever did in their career. For others, it was just a cool little kitschy thing they did, and they didn't mind talking about it like Gordon Hessler. So that was really refreshing.
Yeah, it's weird because, you know, like with Jan and Michael Sherman and Don Boudet, it's like they didn't really have a whole lot of credits to their names. This seemed to be like one of two big things for them.
I think they had one small credit on their resume before this, and I kind of forget. It's probably on the tapes I have with them how they actually got this gig. But it kind of is one of the mysterious things about the movie, for sure.
So you said that the project has kind of stalled out a little bit. Why is that? I mean, obviously, you're still a huge Kiss fan.
Yeah, I'm a full-fledged Kiss nut at this point still. You know, at the time I started to write it, I started to cobble it together. And on the creativity side, one thing that was a little concerning to me was I didn't have a lot of images. I got really close to being able to license some images, and that kind of fell through. There are some excellent images out there, and again, in the years that follow, they have turned up in some official and non-official Kiss products. So on that side, the creative side, you know, with the pictures telling 1,000 words and things like that, I think the images would be really key in doing this book. And on the more personal side, I'm a kiddie entertainer, and at the time, my business started growing, and I felt myself going more towards that. So I was like, you know what? I've done a lot of work on this. I've poured a few hundred hours into it. I do have a lot of material. Let me just sit on it. And I kind of just never went back to it.
Ah, okay. Did you have a name for the book?
Yeah, the book was tentatively called Easy Catman, They Are Serious, The Complete Guide to Kiss Meets the Phantom. I know picturing that on a spine would be hard, but that's a very popular line for the movie. Paul Stanley says it. It's just a famous line from the movie, and I thought it kind of... I thought it was really tongue-in-cheek.
So are you still as big of a fan of the film today as you were all those years ago?
I think I am. I think I am. I think if you look at it, especially as a 70s kid, how could you not love Kiss Meets the Phantom? Again, it really is a coming together of so many cool 70s things. First of all, it's Kiss. And it's Kiss just about at the peak of their powers. It's really when Kiss couldn't, just at the apex, peak cliff, if you will, of their popularity. So it really captured them at a great time, A. B, it has an amusement park in it. And this just goes back to the script writers, and they themselves may have been channeling some free-floating ideas from the 70s. You had Roller Coaster in 76, which was filmed partly in Magic Mountain, where the Kiss film was made, which is right up the five from Hollywood, like 25, 30 minutes up the road. And a lot of things were filmed there. I think Chips filmed there later on. And then you had to see the Phantom aspect. There was Phantom of the Paradise, the movie in the early 70s. There was a lot of Phantom stuff going on. There was even a Wonder Woman episode that had a Phantom thing going on in an amusement park. So it really took all these ideas that were happening in the 70s, as well as a super bunch of icons from the 70s, i.e. Kiss, and put it together. So it really, and it put it together under blue skies. You know, it's totally a great 70s memory to have. And that's why I personally love it, and that's why I think it holds up.
So tell me a little bit more about the business that you're doing now, the one that took off a few years ago.
When I was an editor of a newspaper, I was interviewing a singer-songwriter gal, and she came to me one day. I had to call her back and get some more information from her. I was interviewing her and doing a feature on her. She said, by the way, I got this great job. I'm doing Singing Telegraphs. I'm like, Singing Telegraphs? She goes, yeah, I'm making $40 an hour. And here I am, kind of a starving artist, you know, writing for a living and stuff. And I said, wow, I could do that. So at lunchtime, I went up to the guy's office. He takes a look at me, and he says, you're hired. I said, cool. So I went Saturday to start, but I didn't start doing Singing Telegraphs right away. I started wearing costumes at birthday parties. Scooby-Doo, Pikachu, Teletubbies, all the big characters of the day, Elmo. Within a few months of that, I kind of had enough, and I started doing a face character, you know, what you would call somebody not wearing a mask or a head of a costume. And I called myself Polka Dot, and I started pulling from my influences, and I started doing music and comedy, and since then it just kind of started growing. I'm like a family entertainer, again, that does music, comedy. I DJ, I have a full kiddie rock and roll band, I do shows, I do big shows, little shows, fairs, festivals, schools, things like that. And it kind of has a life of its own at this point.
I have just a couple more questions for you here. Stuff that I jotted down to myself the last time I was watching Kiss Meets the Phantom of the Park. And I wanted to get, since you probably have seen this movie far more times than I have, I wanted to get your opinion on this. In your opinion, are all the robots in the park humans that have been transmorgified into robots? Or do you think it's kind of a mix?
You have Abner Devereaux, by the way, played by the awesome Anthony Zerbe. You know, Anthony Zerbe wouldn't talk to me, by the way. His assistant got back to me numerous times. Very cool, very respectful of the project. Just said that Anthony's busy or Anthony doesn't want to talk. He would be somebody, if I ever picked up the project, I would just keep going at, saying, dude, please talk to me. But in the movie, I think it's indicated that he does make these robotic creatures cybernetic beings, as described in the script. A, so we do have some robot action going on, and B, he has the ability to also take over humans with circuitry and make them a half-human robot breed who can do all his evil bidding.
The other thing is, what do you think happens to Abner at the end of the film?
Isn't that a crazy scene? I was just thinking about that yesterday when I knew I was going to be talking to you. You know, they just could have had him getting carted off in handcuffs. Like, don't worry, you're going to go away for what you've done. But, you know, they went really wackadoo and did this thing where he's sitting and he somehow aged himself and put himself in a coma of sorts through doing all this. And that would have been great if we saw that on screen, how he went from, you know, trying to destroy Kiss in the park, and then you saw him getting a little grayer and a little grayer and a little more wrinkly, and finally he's just frozen in time. Like, he was his own Medusa or something. So I think he just, by doing what he was doing, I think he just simultaneously combusted into stone.
Of the four solo albums, which one is your favorite?
My favorite, here comes the Kiss fans throwing digital vegetables at me, would have to be Peter Criss's album, the Green Album, as they call it. I had saved up my allowance for that. I was getting $4 a week at the time, and it was on sale for $3.99 at Bradley's, a local department store chain. And with tax, it came out to $4.24 at the time. My dad gave me the tax money, and I bought that record first. Loved this cover of Tossin' and Turnin'. And as the years have gone on, it's still my favorite because he put the most heart into it. Again, that's another thing in history that I could debate all day. It's just one of those things that became, oh, that's bad, that's terrible. Meanwhile, you have Gene Simmons, just, it's an album where he's doing nothing but bragging. Look how many friends I can get. Look how many people I can get from Hollywood to be on this record. Half-baked songs, half-baked production. So if you were to ask me, and you did, I'd say it's Peter's.
I want y'all to know something, just in case you're starting to get tired. We are just getting started! Yes, indeed!
Welcome back to the Projection Booth. We're talking about Kiss Meets the Phantom of the Park, the famed or infamous TV movie. So we're all set up from the earlier part of the film. The second half of the film kind of plays out with a lot of fighting. You know, like any good superheroes, Kiss has to battle their way through a heck of a lot of bad guys.
I always the heads over you, Paul.
Get temporarily defeated, and then come back to save the day. John, you had mentioned a little bit earlier that whole idea that they're going to replace Kiss with the fake Kiss, who are going to go out on stage and sing Rip and Destroy. And apparently that is going to really upset Calvin, the owner of the park or something. Somehow this is going to make Abner succeed. Abner Devereaux, the mastermind who's down in his little cave and kind of really controlling everything that's happening. He's the puppet master, if you will.
So that's the way it's to be, is it? Then let the dance begin.
So I do want to say, in the original script, you know, there are none of these electronic bars. You know, we've got Kiss, after they've defeated all of these guys, they've gone through and they've beat up werewolf animatronics, and they had a fight against Dracula and Frankenstein and all these guys, and then they're finally defeated and they're thrown into this little cell. In the original script, it is Peter Criss who manages to save them, not this telepathy that they use, even though they don't have their talismans. When they want to get their talismans back, Peter's able to communicate with this errant cat who's there in the laboratory.
Is that true?
Has the cat push the talismans over to there so they can grab them. It's kind of, it's almost as good as when the Brady Bunch had all their belts together and they threw them over there in order to, you know, defeat Mr. Howell when he was locked them up out in, the Grand Canyon. So it was a very intricate plot here.
Getting into this is, to me, and John sort of hit the nail on the head with this. This movie came out in an era when a lot of fans probably couldn't see the band live. And there was no MTV, there wasn't a lot of concerts on TV all the time and stuff like that. You didn't have the internet. And to me, the film kind of falls apart because it doesn't meet the expectation of what a fan would want. Like, to me, like, the best rock and roll movie ever is Hard Day's Night. And in that, it's just a bunch of excuses to get the Beatles to play their songs in some sort of plot. In this, as we said, they don't show up until like 30 minutes in, and then nothing really happens until about an hour. And it's so convoluted that it doesn't really even work as a film and is kind of a disappointment even for fans.
And it's funny that you say Hard Day's Night, because I remember Paul Stanley saying that the original concept of the movie was a Hard Day's Night meets Star Wars. It never comes together because, you don't really see the band that much. It's like it would have been much better to have just a very, very simple script and them just playing their music.
When these guys are in their makeup the whole time, they're supposed to be this mysterious group and all this. I mean, I keep thinking of like the Gene character, where it's like, you know, he just kind of skulks around through the whole movie. You don't really get a whole lot of that kind of, you know, camaraderie that we have in A Hard Day's Night, where it looks like the boys are having fun. In this, it looks like they're all pretty miserable, and we got the one-liners that they pass back and forth, but otherwise it's just they're not having a good time running away from chicks or anything. And you can't run in those boots anyway.
No, you can't.
And I like the one-liners, I have to say, and maybe I can get John to spout a few more of them for us.
I'll handle this, Sneed.
In one of the documentaries about Kiss, and I don't remember which one it is because I went through a period where I was watching a bunch of them, there was this little discussion between Gene and Paul, and it was almost like Paul was like, and we decided that it wouldn't be good if Gene kept acting. And it was almost like this whole, like, you know, the husband and wife had a discussion, and the husband really wants to do something, wants to play in a band or something like that. But we had a family discussion, and we decided that it just wasn't going to work out with him, you know, pursuing his dream of being in this band. And Gene just seems very like, you know, yes, dear.
I think it was like in 1992 when they were like recapping everything after Eric Card passed away and Eric Singer had joined the band. And Bruce Kulick comes on and says, Gene was supposed to be in the studio, but he's filming a movie. And then I think the quote was, and then Gene got his brain back. you know, and then he just became part of KISS and he stopped acting.
Gene was probably the best actor of the four, and I liked what he did with some of his roles. I mean, Runaway was amazing. Wanted Dead or Alive is pretty darn good. And his epic turn as Velvet Von Wrenger in Never Too Young to Die is the stuff that dreams are made of.
My little turd balls. My little scum buckets. Squeeze them good. But good. Figured out how to access their computers, rechannel radioactive waste, so it goes from Diablo Canyon into their drinking water. Poison the water supply. I'm gonna poison their water supply for gold, for ransom, for jewels, for money. How are we going to do this? With all the info we have crammed onto our little computer disk, our own little Ramke. But there's a slight glitch. Someone has stolen our disk.
Yeah, and it's especially now, looking back, I think he may think, boy, I wish I would have kept doing the acting because, you know, today you don't really, you know, albums don't sell. You know, you don't put a record out every year. You know, he could have built a body of work elsewhere.
Though he does have the TV show, which is like one of the most scripted reality shows ever.
I know. Yeah, and the first season was really good, and then right after that it became scripted, and I said Gene took control of this and destroyed it. You know, it's completely scripted, and it's awful now. He has a tendency to do that.
Yeah, every half hour was very much a sitcom. I mean, at the end of the show, everything was back to the way it was at the beginning of the show. The problems had been worked out. You know, I remember one where he goes to Vegas and is hanging out with Carrot Top and gets a dildo glued to his hand. And I was like, this is like an update of an old I Love Lucy episode. This is not a reality show.
Yeah, where she gets the beard on her face and she needs Bulldog Cement Remover number 5. But yeah, it's the same thing.
Well, I think they slept in separate beds in I Love Lucy, so dildos were, you know, 50 years away from that.
But they were as big as a basement. The technology didn't advance at that time. So.
The Univac vibrator. Yes.
It's diesel powered.
Really, when I look at Kiss Meets the Phantom of the Park, the one thing that always goes through my mind, and I guess it helps that it was a Hanna-Barbera production, is that basically the whole episode is a Scooby-Doo episode.
Completely.
You know, at the end, they don't like rip off Abner Devereaux's face and it actually ends up being Calvin or Sneed or somebody very similar, which is great because, you know, Kiss would end up going on to be on Scooby-Doo. And that kind of really, you know, fits them kind of perfectly.
Yeah, it would have gotten away with it too if
it hadn't been for us meddling kids, right? Got it. Thanks.
And speaking of the Scooby-Doo, like the doubles, that goes back to, I remember, like, to Mission Impossible, where they would have the rubber mask and somebody would be impersonating somebody and they would pull the mask on and then they would cut and then it would be that actor pretending like the mask was now on. It was like,
so we've talked a little bit about some of the differences between the European cut and the American cut. And of course, the music is one of the biggest things. So you get more of the solo albums, which is great because it's, you know, the solo albums had just come out. So they had to, you know, they're always about marketing and commercialization, so they had to use that music when it came to the foreign version of it. And the other thing, there's an Italian cut of this just called Kiss Phantoms, which, oh my god, right in the middle of concert scenes, like it'll be between songs in those like two concerts, because you had the one in the middle and the one at the very end after they defeat the bad guys, the robots and everything, it will cut to a promo video. Like, out of the blue, it goes from them on stage and it goes right to basically the music video of You Sure Know Something and I Was Made for Loving You. They're not even wearing the same costumes. They're not in front of a live audience. It just goes right to these things for 3 minutes or whatever. And then it goes back into the movie.
I need to go on the internet and find that. That's
yes,
good.
Yes, you do. It is great. And it's great to hear Kiss overdubbed in Italian, too.
Ah, sono ragazzi pieni di vita e di allegria, così come il nostro parco di divertimenti. Abbiamo giostre, attrazioni, e ora abbiamo anche i Kiss. Questi ragazzi sono venuti ad applaudire i loro beniamini.
I heard that Italian version was done by Fellini because he had such a love of clowns, right? And Kiss with the makeup.
You never know. And all the women have hairy legs in it, too. It's very strange.
The other biggest difference is the end of the film, and I don't get this whatsoever. In the end of the European version, you know, you got that scene of Melissa just begging and pleading and, you know, like, give me back my Sam and blah, blah, blah. They have that little thing over on Sam's neck that basically turned him into a robot. And in the European version, Paul uses his laser eyes and zaps that thing. And it you know, explodes, a little explosion. Then it's like, okay, Sam is back. Whew. And in the American version, it makes no sense to me because, you know, she's like, give me back my Sam. And they go over and they see the thing. And somebody just goes and just takes it right off of his neck. And he's back. Yeah. It's like, okay, you know, just pull that thing right off. But the other greatest thing about the European version is that after they, you know, Devereaux turns around and he's all old and everything, which makes absolutely no sense, there's another shot of a young Devereaux walking through the park, just kind of, you know, like almost like he's getting away finally, which hopefully will lead to the sequel project that I've been working for about 20 years on now, which is the return of the Phantom of the Park. So
that would be awesome.
I need to make a giant roller coaster out of toilet paper tubes, and then I've got my set and I'm all set for it.
The question is if you can't get Kiss to come back, what band would play the band?
And I got the 12-inch action figures. That's what I got. I'm going to do it just like, you know, Todd Haynes. I'm going to shoot it all with action figures. All I need is to get the little Abner Devereaux action figure, and I think I might get like an Eric Carr and a Vinnie Vincent in there to make kind of, you know, special cameo appearances. And I do have a 12-inch Fonz and Arlie Ermey, so maybe they can make appearances as well.
That's right, folks. Welcome to GeekCon 2013.
The other thing that I find very funny, my wife actually bought me tickets for the Phantom of the Opera in Toronto, and unfortunately, like a week before I went to it, I ruined my own surprise by finding out that Paul Stanley was being the Phantom, which is great that he was, because he played a wonderful Phantom, because, you know, the Phantom's face is all screwed up and everything, and Paul's got that great, like, speech impediment, and so him up there, like, screaming, Christine! It was just like perfect. I love
it. And he would sing with this weird British accent now and then. I remember watching it going, Paul, what are you doing? Just, you know how to sing, just sing. It was great too, because like if you ever go to a Broadway show or something like that, or a musical, you know the kind of people you're going to see. But I remember I went to this, and then you would see a guy with real long hair just wearing a tie. You know? A bunch of people that look like defendants, like on their way to court. You
know? I wore my t-shirt with the tuxedo on it.
Exactly. Like, and then after he would sing a song, people like yelling out, like, whoa, you know. So I was really hoping, though, he would do more of that, because after I saw him, I said, you know, that was pretty good. That's a very, very hard role to do. But then, you know, he didn't do any more, and that kind of bummed me out.
We're going to take a break and play a preview for next week's show.
No! Put the gun down!
Hear your names. Mr. White, Mr. Blonde, Mr. Pink.
Why am I Mr. Pink?
Who cares what your name is?
Yeah, that's easy for you to say. You're Mr. White. You have a cool-sounding name.
Let's go to work.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight. I got the feeling there's something right.
What happens if the manager won't give you the diamonds?
Cut off one of his fingers. The little one.
I'm so scared because I fall off the chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs.
If they hadn't done what I told them not to do, they'd still be alive.
It's so hard to keep the smile from my face. I'm all over the place.
You're acting like a first-year thief. I'm acting like a professional.
And you're mad.
Years,
taking out some
no choice at all.
Bam.
Bam, 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 bam,
bam. You're under arrest, sugar. Harvey Keitel, Tim Roth, Chris Penn, Steve Buscemi, Lawrence Tierney, and Michael Madsen. They're the Reservoir Dogs.
Hey, Joe, I'm going to shoot this guy.
That That's right. We're back next week to discuss Quentin Tarantino's Reservoir Dogs, joined by co-host Jamie Jenkins of Devour the Podcast. We'll have an interview with Paul Zimmerman and many, many more surprises, including your phone calls, because you called in, right?
Hopefully you did. But before we go, we need to thank this week's special co-host, John Stockwell. Now, John, we introduce you as the star child, and that is not a joke. Please tell the folks at home just a little bit more why you have that nickname.
All right.
Many years ago, when I was living in California, like in 1994, my friends and I started a Kiss tribute band called Destroyer. Originally, we were a five-piece where I wore Paul's bandit makeup and sang lead vocals, and we had a star child that played guitar. We actually opened for Kiss when they played in San Francisco on their convention tour. As the band went on, our one star child left, so I learned how to play rhythm guitar and started wearing the star. And when I moved here to Detroit, we kept the band going as Detroit Rock City and did it up until like the year 2000. And if you go to the Kiss Spin Magazine issue where they have the four different covers, I was actually interviewed in there about the band and stuff like that. And so doing the tribute band was like was really, really fun. But I always did it just as a part-time thing. I always had a full-time job. But a lot of strange things would happen, too. Like after we would play, people would want me to sign their Kiss memorabilia. You know? And I remember this one guy brought me some Paul Stanley trading cards from 1978, and I said to him, I go, look, I'm going to devalue this if I sign it. That is not me. You know? But I don't know. I signed it for him anyway, and he got on his short bus and, you know, and went away. So
I once knew a Kiss cover band guy. He was Ace Frehley, and he was so into it that he started doing heroin.
See, that's awesome. See, and for me, I always saw the goofiness of it, that all these people would come and watch you play and go berserk, and then I would always be thinking, but I'm not the real guy. You know, it's like if you really knew the guy that you're up there cheering for, you wouldn't come see me, because I'm just, you know, but my life really isn't that exciting. And it was the strangest thing, because as I'm playing, I'm realizing the absurdity of it all at the same time. It was a very, very, very strange but really fun time.
Were you ever approached to sign some boobs?
No, I wasn't. It would have been a really fun thing to have a documentary crew following us around, because it was just really funny to what goes into it, but then the people's reactions. And I remember one show we did at the IROC nightclub here in Detroit, I overloaded one of the flash pods, and it exploded like a grenade, and it shredded the bass cabinet, and pieces of shrapnel went flying over people's heads. My wife was very mad at me. She's like, you could have killed somebody. But I was laughing hysterically. Nobody got hurt, but it did destroy the bass cabinet and one of the monitors up front. So
could have been like Great White all over again.
Yeah, and like a few years before that happened. Yeah, but then after that, we actually got the kind of flash pots that are preloaded. But this, you know, you just kind of scooped in the gunpowder. I'm like, oh, this will be a good show. I'll put in a little extra into this metal container. And it was like a grenade going off. Like pieces of metal just went flying at bullet force out into the crowd. It was the loudest sound I ever heard, because it was pumped through the PA. I remember the next day, our drummer called us up. We were trying to act all serious, like, oh, dude, that was really bad. That was really bad. I can't believe it. And finally, about 2 minutes into the conversation, he just burst into laughter. You know, he's like, that was great. I can't believe it. And then I burst into laughter, and it was, you know.
You know, you talked about at the one convention that you guys opened for him. So if you had a chance to meet the guys, and sort of how was that, if you did?
I have. I remember after the here's the funny thing, too, about when we played the Kiss convention, we came up with a set list of like real hardcore songs, because I said, you know, these guys are paying, people are paying $100 to get in here. You know, we're going to play All American Man and Almost Human and Strange Ways. And we played these songs and people were just staring at us. Is this a Kiss song? You know, it's like our guy who does Gene spits blood, and instead of God of Thunder, he goes into Almost Human. Yeah, I'm like, oh, right. This is going to be awesome. And people are just staring at us as if, what are they doing? I have no idea what these songs are. Yeah, I remember after the show, and this was like right out of a Bill and Ted movie, I'm walking to my car, or I'm walking to the little hallway to get to my car, and Paul Stanley comes up. And like, he thanked me for doing the show. You know, he's like, hey, I really enjoyed it. You know, thanks for doing the show. I'm like, hey, well, yeah, you're welcome. You know, thank you. So,
you know, the ladies always call me Mr. Speed, but I don't think it's a compliment.
And speaking of Mr. Speed, I sang that song. This is not planned. I sang that song on a Kiss tribute CD.
Nice. So. As the Paul Stanley of the group, one of the Paul Stanleys, did you do the between song banter?
My favorite thing I would do that Paul would do, it was be like, he would say something and then say it again. He would say, I got a question for you. I got a question for you. And then he would always say, this comes from the album Kiss Alive. Yeah, but that was my favorite thing to do because, yeah, that's what he would always say. Like, this comes from Kiss Alive.
I had a friend who said that Nirvana would have been much better had they done between song banter like that. Like, are you feeling a little crazy tonight? I said, are you feeling a little crazy? Well, how about we do some lithium?
Hey, and Nirvana does a great cover of Do You Love Me, which is hard to find. They covered Do You Love Me from Kiss.
Yeah, that was much better. That one, that Seattle one, much better than like the one with, who was it, like Garth Brooks and stuff.
Yeah, Kiss My Ass with Lenny Kravitz and Gin Blossoms. Kiss appeared with the Gin Blossoms on David Letterman, and it was just really weird. Because Paul and Gene are tall anyway, and they just look like giants, even in normal shoes next to the Gin Blossom guys. It was very awkward.
One of my favorites when it comes to a cover version is not really, I guess it's not really a cover version because it's the actual vocals. You can find it on YouTube. Is this reggae version of Detroit Rock City that's pretty incredible.
I have one last question for you, John. Of the four solo albums, which one is your favorite?
I would pick Paul's as the favorite, just because it sounds most like, you know, a Kiss record. And it's got one song, Take Me Away, which I think is one of the best songs that he ever wrote on there, which I think is good. But every song is really, really awesome. I would definitely pick Paul's.
Very nice. Rob, how about you?
he likes Vinnie Vincent Invasion.
Nice.
I'm just going to shut up.
Yeah, Paul's album is awesome, though. Ace is good, too. Ace is outstanding.
Ace is my favorite one.
Well, put it this way. I appreciate Kiss for one big reason. We all be in Detroit, guys. Kiss yes. Live, partly recorded here, Kobo. So there you go.
That's right.
Well, thanks for coming by the show, John. It was a pleasure. We should have you back if we can find another film that you really love or it's another Kiss movie.
Yeah, if you ever talk about The King of Comedy with Robert De Niro and Jerry Lewis.
That is on our list. We've been trying to get Sandra Bernhardt for a while. Or Marty, or Bobby, or Jerry. Anybody wants to give us a call, you know, feel free.
Make sure to go to projection-booth.com. Check out the website. Leave us some feedback. You can click on the links and have a good time and learn all about John Stockwell's top secret program over there on how to improve your waistline. And and of course, we'll be back next week with more fun and all of that stuff. So rock and roll all night and party every day, y'all.
There is only one city in America. There is only one city in the world. There is only one city in America that I wrote a song about. There is one city in America that took us in, opened up your arms and opened up your legs to us. So there's a city, and that city deserved a song. There are a lot of great cities in America, but there is only one.
wonder who could have done it.
Good question, Catman. What do you compute, Space Ace?
Insufficient data at the moment, Star Child.
Said we were crazy to attempt this. Maybe we are crazy, but that's what makes us Kiss. We've created another page in Kistory tonight. This is awesome.